I worry because that water is big and deep and broad and many, many, many times dangerous.
A U.S. Senate field hearing on the Coast Guard's role in the changing Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 6th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, listening in on whale chatter from an old lighthouse near Petersburg.
There's a sound we hear a lot that we call a purr drop, and it sounds like a lion purring followed by a raindrop. Like,
those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
A former fisheries aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski, convicted of falsifying his own fishing records, is scheduled for release from prison by Saturday. According to the U.S. Bureau of Prisons, Arnie Fugelvog has been serving time at a minimum security camp in Virginia. Fugelvog last year pleaded guilty to falsifying commercial fishing records for profit. He resigned as an aide to Murkowski shortly before his plea deal with prosecutors was made public. He was sentenced to 5 months in prison, and it was known he was helping prosecutors in another case. Fugelvog recently testified against an Oregon man who once operated a fishing vessel co-owned by Fugelvog. Freddie Joe Hankins faces up to 5 years in prison after being convicted of falsely reporting where he caught fish in Alaska. The Alaska State Troopers have identified the officer involved in a fatal shooting on Friday. He is Sergeant Paul Anthony Tony Wegzin. Wegzin shot and killed Justin Lloyd Abrahamson after Abrahamson advanced on troopers with a raised bat during an early morning incident on the Glen Highway. Troopers say Wegzin is a 9-year veteran of the troopers and is assigned to the Palmer Post. The Alaska Bureau of Investigation will investigate the shooting and forward results to the Department of Law's Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals for determination if lethal force was warranted. Two U.S. senators met for a field hearing in Kodiak today to discuss the future of the Arctic. They were especially focused on what expanded shipping and oil drilling in the Arctic Ocean will mean for the United States Coast Guard. KMXT's Brianna Gibbs has more.
Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu was a few thousand miles away from her stomping grounds of Louisiana when she joined Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski in Kodiak. The two sat before a field hearing of local residents, Coast Guardsmen, and an expert panel to address the future of the Arctic and what it means for the United States Coast Guard. Admiral Robert J. Papp was a fitting panelist to kick off the discussion. As Commandant of the entire U.S. Coast Guard, he spoke to what melting sea ice and expansion of industry in the Arctic has done to the Coast Guard's already limited resources.
Think about if your city or your county or your parish incorporated a new portion of land or gained some additional space and area, but you never increased your police force or you never increased your fire department. They would take on added responsibilities, added burdens, and they'd have to spread the existing resources a little bit thinner in order to accomplish the mission.
Murkowski and Landrieu said they were discouraged by the declining funds the nation has put toward protecting the coast and said they were working together to change that. Murkowski focused on the need for icebreakers in the north, along with more law enforcement as fisheries expand northward and oil and gas exploration intensifies.
I worry because that water is big and deep and broad and many, many, many times dangerous. And whether you're on the sea or whether you're the helo in the air plucking fishermen out of waves that are 20 feet high and gales that are blasting, we put you in harm's way, and we've got an obligation to ensure that you have the assets to do what you do so honorably.
Landrieu, who serves as the chair of the Homeland Security and Appropriations Subcommittee, is no stranger to coastal waters. While her home state of Louisiana is a far cry from the Arctic, she said she is empathetic to the state's fishing industry and has the Coast Guard to thank for being first on the scene to natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina. But perhaps more so than anything, Landrieu said she can attest to the immense resources needed to pursue oil and gas drilling. She spoke from experience, too. After all, it was Louisiana that felt the greatest effects of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in 2010.
It may be shocking, Senator, to think about this, but 47,000 personnel and 7,000 vessels responded to that accident. I mean, we're sitting in the largest air base here, and we only have 1,000 personnel. I don't think you have nearly 7,000 vessels anywhere close. And that response had to be done immediately. And I think the nation has to really come to grips with the exploration opportunities for oil and gas, the great need of the nation to have our own domestic resource, but the extra responsibility that comes with that to provide the vessels and the manpower to take care of something if, like in that situation, something went terribly wrong.
The dire need for ice-breaking vessels was a reoccurring topic during the hearing. Landrieu said the U.S. is an Arctic nation, but one would not assume that if they considered the resources the Coast Guard is working with. Admiral Papp, who agreed, addressed the question of what is currently in operation.
So that'll give us one heavy breaker and one medium breaker, and that's my bridging strategy over the next probably decade until we get the new polar icebreaker built.
The field hearing was intended to provide testimony for the need of additional funds to the Coast Guard. The two senators are currently working on a bill that would allocate $10.336 billion to the Coast Guard, $282 million above the president's request. Murkowski and Landrieu will continue their Alaskan visit in the coming days, visiting other communities that rely on the Coast Guard. In Kodiak, I'm Brianna Gibbs.
A handful of environmental organizations, including a couple based in Alaska, have filed suit against the EPA regarding the use of dispersants to respond to oil spills. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The lawsuit was filed on behalf of eight plaintiffs, including the Alaska Community Action on Toxics and Cook Inlet Keeper. Bob Shavelson is the inlet keeper for Cook Inlet Keeper, based in Homer.
We recognize that industry learned with the Exxon Valdez that they did not want to see oil hitting the beaches and failing lava because it's a public relations nightmare, and nobody wants to see that. But with the BP spill in the Gulf, they dumped millions and millions of gallons of dispersants to drive that oil into the water column, and the growing body of evidence is that created more toxicity than simply the oil itself. So what we're trying to do right now is to force EPA to do what it's supposed to do under the law and to say, where can you apply these dispersants and in what volumes?
It's estimated that almost 2 million gallons of chemical dispersants were used to respond to the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster, and the chemicals are apparently stockpiled in several locations in Alaska to respond to an oil spill. Shavelson is concerned that without additional research by the EPA, dispersants will be the first thing used to respond to an oil spill.
And the problem is, increasingly, they are the first tool that gets pulled out. So instead of trying to use mechanical means to control the spill, they'll go in and pull out dispersants first because, again, out of sight, out of mind.
The lawsuit was filed Monday, and the plaintiffs are asking the court to force the EPA to publish a schedule that identifies dispersants and other oil spill control agents that would be eligible to be used to respond to an oil spill. They also want the EPA to identify where dispersants can be used and in what quantities. The plaintiffs believe the EPA is required to publish that information as part of preparing the National Oil and Hazardous Substances Pollution Contingency Plan. Shavelson says Cook Inlet Keeper is concerned that dispersants will be the first choice if something goes wrong in the sensitive waters of Cook Inlet.
Well, we're seeing a new wave of development in Cook Inlet. We've got one jackup rig drilling right now. We've got another one on the way from Singapore that should be drilling within the next month or so. They're drilling into unknown formations with unknown pressures. So the risk of a blowout is always there. We've had a history of blowouts in Cook Inlet. So it's important to recognize how we're going to respond to a spill before the spill actually happens.
Dispersants basically work by dispersing oil into small droplets that can then disperse throughout the entire water column. They don't get rid of the oil. They just move it off the water surface. Monday's lawsuit was filed by the public interest environmental law firm, Earth Justice. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an epic journey from the tip of South America to Alaska in a Ford truck.
You know, one of our amazing scenes in our trip We saw a grizzly bear chasing a moose on the road.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Jamie Lynn Gray has won a gold medal in the 50-meter three-position rifle event at the London Olympics. In a video posted on YouTube by the U.S. Olympic Committee, the former University of Alaska Fairbanks shooter said she went into the event with a plan.
I prepared pretty well for a windy day, and that's what we got. We had rain on and off. And, you know, I set a match plan with my sports psychologist yesterday and followed it completely through to the tee. And, you know, it was everything from how I'm going to shoot in the wind, what I'm going to do if it's picking up, letting off, you know, how to recover from a shot that I lost in the wind. And it ended up really well, obviously.
Gray shot a total of 691.9 total points, including a 99.9 in the final round, setting an Olympic record. She calls her win indescribable.
I don't know if it's quite hit me yet either. You know, you work for something for so long. I've been shooting since I was 8 years old, and then I started the international stuff when I was 15. And you know, ever since I was 15, it's, you know, been a dream to, you know, have a medal around your neck.
Gray won fourth place in the air rifle and fifth in the three-position event at the Beijing Olympics 4 years ago. Matt Emmons, who also competed on UAF's rifle team, captured a bronze medal today in the men's 50-meter three-position event. Emmons has two Olympic medals to his name. He won gold in Athens in 2004 and silver in Beijing in 2008 in the 50-meter rifle prone. The 15th International Congress on Circumpolar Health got underway today on the campus of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Scientists, health professionals, and Alaska's congressional delegation will discuss issues related to health in the far north during the week-long conference. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
A group of Native youth dancers from the Tanana Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks performed traditional dances to the fiddle music of well-known musician and elder Bill Stevens. During the opening ceremony of the 15th International Congress on Circumpolar Health, Stevens spoke about his personal experience.
Alcohol and drug abuse is very, you know, rampant all over the villages. And in 1967, I had my last drink and last cigarettes. The way I did it is through people and then through recovery and all that.
The Congress brings together scientists and doctors from 15 countries, including all 9 Arctic nations, to discuss the latest in circumpolar health and medical research. Athabaskan elder Howard Luke gave the invocation. He told an audience of more than 200 people he appreciated their cooperative efforts to address indigenous health and culture in the far north.
My mother always telling me that. You sit with them, whether you know them or not, black or white or yellow, you sit down and share with them.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich also addressed the audience.
Talking about the health of people in the north, may it be suicide prevention or substance abuse or diabetes or all the unique health challenges we have here, as people discuss and see the Arctic and know more about it, these issues of health will be on the forefront.
More than 550 attendees are expected at the week-long conference, which meets every 3 years. They'll gather again in Finland in 2015. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The National Park Service recently finished a study on the impact of trophy grizzly hunting in Katmai Preserve. By Park Service estimates, the harvest numbers are not affecting population or conflicting with other park uses, but some conservation groups and the bear viewing industry are not so sure that's accurate. Before renewing 10-year contracts for sport hunting guides, the NPS would like the public to weigh in. KDLG's Dave Bettinger reports.
Tackling issues of bear hunting is nothing new for Katmai National Park and Preserve, which is designed to protect hunting, says Superintendent Ralph Moore.
One of the purposes for which those preserves throughout Alaska were established was for hunting to be able to be continued. The hunting occurred prior to the establishment of the preserve, and that's an important use of the preserve, so we support and encourage that.
Katmai is home to the world's largest protected population of brown bears, and Moore says NPS is pleased with the management of the iconic species, even with sport and subsistence hunting. But the 10-year contracts for sport hunting guides are set to expire this year. NPS decided to analyze the impacts of hunting as an activity at Katmai. Moore says a recent survey at least shows the bear numbers are good.
We did studies on what the bear population was doing, and this revealed that not only was the population not declining, it was staying stable with the number of clients that we were having go into the area and possibly slightly increasing.
Based on a recently completed environmental assessment, the Park Service wants to keep the harvest numbers the same, up to 28 bears taken on sport tags and another 10 available to subsistence hunters. Others are not convinced the assessment gives a complete picture. Jim Stratton is the Alaska Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association.
Katmai Preserve is a pretty popular bear viewing area, and we were observing a conflict between the bear viewers and the bears that they wanted to view, which are large male brown bears, and of course the target of hunters, which is large male brown bears.
Stratton says an analysis of the conflicting uses of bear viewing and bear hunting was missing in previous studies, so the National Parks Conservation Association asked that it be included in this one.
We encourage the Park Service to, you know, kind of dive in and kind of look at this issue, you know, from a more in-depth perspective. And unfortunately, they didn't address the issue at all.
The assessment did determine that guided hunting for trophy grizzlies in Katmai adds a couple $100,000 to local and regional economies annually. But bear viewing is big business, too.
I take clients out. I get paid to take them out and see bears. And for that, they stay in hotels and B&Bs in Homer and other places in Alaska. You know, that's basically how I make my living.
That's Dave Backrack, who owns and operates AK Adventures. He says the revenue stream from bear viewing was overlooked in the assessment.
The only economic impact analysis in the environmental assessment is on how bear hunting will affect the economy.
Backrack's clients pay a premium to fly to remote areas of Katmai and watch bears, especially the big male grizzlies, which are exactly what the trophy hunters pay a premium to kill. Backrack sees a conflict between the two uses and says the assessment missed the chance to offer a solution.
There's a lack of alternatives, and they really need to have an alternative that addresses the user conflict between viewers and hunters, and it's just not there.
He and others still have concerns about the fair chase ethics of hunting these bears that spend their lives in front of a human audience.
They are habituated to people. You know, they really can't tell the difference whether you're pointing a Canon or an Nikon camera at them or a high-powered hunting rifle. It's just people out there.
A couple of years ago, shocking video footage of hunters killing what appeared to be a very habituated grizzly was broadcast on TV and YouTube. It raised plenty of questions at the time. That's not for NPS to address. The right to hunt in the preserve is congressionally protected. But for the next decade, how many bears can be harvested and from what areas of the preserve has yet to be determined. NPS would like the public to weigh in. The environmental assessment and a link to submit comments is available at the website parkplanning.nps.gov. The comment period is open through August 2nd. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. For the past two summers, the Five Finger Lighthouse near Petersburg has hosted humpback whale research. A graduate student from Oregon State works with a rotating team of interns to study the impact of vessel noise on humpback whale communication. The historic building perches at the confluence of Stevens Passage and Frederick Sound and brings a healthy dose of whimsy to the earthly world of science. KFSK's Alexis Kenyon has more.
The Juneau Lighthouse Association and the Alaska Whale Foundation have funded the Rapunzel Project out of the Five Finger Lighthouse for the past two summers. Michelle Fournet, a graduate student at Oregon State University, is leading the project. Fournet says they got the name for the operation last year, One evening, they were sitting around the dinner table with Dr. Andy Szabo, the project advisor, and the head of the Alaska Whale Foundation.
And I think Andy was the one who was like, you guys should just call yourself the Rapunzel Project. And he was teasing us, you know, like, oh, a bunch of ladies in a tower. But the name stuck. So our boat is called Noble Steed. If you're in the tower, you're Rapunzel. And it works because this is a pretty whimsical place. Those are our two resident bald eagles that hang out there on that reef. There's a juvenile on the island, so they had to check this out.
The place is whimsical. Rocky cliffs, soft flowering grass. In the distance, blue snow-capped mountains of Baranof Island line the horizon. But most importantly, during the summer, thousands of humpback whales swim to these waters to feed. And the team surveys for 12 hours a day.
We'll get up about 2:30, put on a pot of tea. So I go shove off Noble Steed. They will call up to Rapunzel in the tower. Is my position good? They say, oh yeah, position looks great. Then they'll drop their two hydrophones. And once they're in position, they'll begin recording.
The hydrophones, which are basically high-tech waterproof microphones, connected to headphones, record every sound they detect in the water. With two hydrophones, they can determine the location and the direction of the sounds.
We get a snapshot, a 30-minute snapshot, of what the whales looked like, where their positions were, how big the group size was, how many animals were in the area, when vessels were passing through. And then we also get this acoustic snapshot of exactly what the world sounded like during that 30-minute period.
They can make maps from the data retroactively.
And I can say, okay, the whales in this general area, one of them was the one that was vocalizing. And I can say, well, what was going on spatially in that area?
But even without the maps, Fournet says the whale noises aren't that cryptic. She describes the first time she dropped the hydrophone for a listen.
Within seconds, you could hear chatter. And it wasn't just a little bit of chatter. It was big, loud, booming whops and thwops and cackles, as if we had joined a dinner party.
And just from listening and recording, they've made discoveries.
They're making noises that I did not know they were making. You know, some that we knew that they make, there's a sound we hear a lot that we call a purr drop. And it sounds like a lion purring followed by a raindrop. Like, and that sound's been recorded in other places, but to hear it live was just so cool. You're like, that's a whale, and it sounds like a lion raindrop animal.
Since she's been at the lighthouse, Fournet has put together her own catalog of whale sounds.
When I can play them for our interns and be like, okay, these are the sounds you need to look out for. The looks on their faces as they hear these things. There's one that sounds just like that old roller derby song, Wipeout. It's like, whoa, 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 Wipeout. And that's what the whale sounds like.
As far as vessel noise and its impact on the whales, Fournet says nothing is certain, especially at this stage of research. But departing intern Nicole Chabanet seems pretty sold it's got to have some impact.
When you put those hydrophones on your ears and there's a vessel ride, all you hear is like, grrr. So I got a headache the first day I was listening to it. You know, and I'm not a whale. I don't depend on this water to like communicate with people. It's horrible.
Chabanet says hearing the vessel noise and living on the island for a month has given her a new appreciation for humans' impact on our ecosystem.
I definitely think we need to do some modifications because I definitely agree that people need to harvest to eat and feed themselves. But there's a way to do it in a way where you're less damaging to other creatures around you. We tend to think that as humans, this is our planet and we have dibs on everything. But it's not true. You know, we have to be more careful.
Nicole!
Anaki!
Yeah, your phone number, your password's Raindrop. You love them. Let's go.
The interns boat out to the charter that is waiting to take them back.
My mom didn't pick up.
Oh!
Like, I want to say, but there's all the things I have to do too. But I want to say.
Life goes.
Really?
The boat pulls away from the island. Fournet stands out front on the boat ramp, waving goodbye.
Bye!
With the help of the new interns, she will spend the next month and a half at Five Finger Lighthouse finishing her field research. After that, for her master's thesis at Oregon State University, she will begin the process of analyzing the sounds and information she's found. At Five Finger Lighthouse, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
Alaska lures visitors from all over the world during its peak summer season, but Eduardo Isa and his wife Leticia Rodriguez probably take the cake for putting the most miles on a vehicle to get here. The two drove to Alaska from the furthest point in South America in Argentina.
I had this dream, 10 years dream, to cross America from the bottom to the top. We passed through 19 countries already, And it was an amazing experience. We left Brazil March last year, and we went down south first to Patagonia area in Ushuaia. It's the last city on the bottom of South America. And then we start to come up to the Pacific side from Chile and then Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia.
The couple is from a small town near Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, but have long dreamed of driving the entire coastline of both North and South America. They have made the trek in a Ford truck with a custom-built camper on the bed. Their trip included Cuba, among the places they stopped at that can't be reached by road.
There is a part of the bottom of Central America that there is no road. It's called Darien Gap. In this area, you have to put the car in a ferry and across to Panama.
Eduardo says his impression of Cuba was grim.
They are becoming far and far away from the technology. And you see the people, they have no emails. They don't have access of internet. And they don't have cars, good cars. They live in houses and apartments. It's in ruins. They have no money to rebuild.
He says they had no problems traveling from one country to the next and felt safe all the way through Central America and Mexico. They completed the northbound trek on the East Coast, U.S., and then drove west through both Canada and the U.S., then up the Alcan. The most memorable event along the Alcan?
I think this is one of the best parts of this trip, the Alaska Highway. From White Horse to the Alaska border, we saw just in one day 18 bears. And the next day we saw 2 grizzly bears. And one of our amazing scenes in our trip, we saw a grizzly bear chasing a moose on the road. And then they went inside a lake and the moose swimming and the grizzly swimming behind was incredible. And after 15 minutes, the grizzly quit. He couldn't afford to go behind the moose. The moose is very fast in the water.
Eduardo and Leticia also drove to Prudhoe Bay, toured Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula, and have put 50,000 miles on the truck before heading south to see what the west coast of the Americas looks like. Check out his website at travelisiadasamericas.com.br. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Mike Mason and Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Alexis Kenyon in Petersburg. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.